Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Well, tonight we're very happy to bring back to Denver a very talented author who writes in one of my favorite time periods. Ever since I was little, listening to my grandfather's stories of World War II, I was always more interested in the time periods before that led up to the war and afterwards in the aftermath. Always kind of fascinated me. So, obviously, pretty much all of tonight's author's books get me pretty excited. Please join me in welcoming Joseph Gannon.
Thank you all for coming. I'm always so astonished and pleased when people come out when they have so many other things that they might be doing. So it's flattering. I know these events are usually billed as readings, but I don't like to be read to myself. And so what I tend to do in bookstores is I like to talk about the book to you directly and how it came to be, how it was put together, etc., and then we can ask questions about anything specifically you want to know, if that's okay with you. I just think that, you know, the opportunity to be face-to-face with people, you don't need to see me read. Much better to see me try to remember what it is that I was going to say, you know, and not do it. Anyway, you know, every website now has this little area called FAQs, F-A-Q-S. I'd frequently ask questions. I confess that for several years, I thought it was a cute computerese way of saying facts, F-A-C-T-S, and so I never actually clicked it. And it was when one of my sons rolled his eyes and said, no, you know, it's this. The most frequently asked question that I get, if we're in one of these book in event environments, is where did you get the idea? I think in part people ask this because I write in period as opposed to right now, and they want to know why that time, does it mean something to you? I think people also think that all fiction now is so autobiographical that novels are really just a form of diaries, and since mine obviously aren't, they're curious about why I write about that time, that place. But I think larger than those reasons is that there's a kind of magical thinking quality to the whole creative process. Where do ideas come from? There's no real answer to this question, this frequently asked question. We imagine that they come fully formed through the Ethernet and they land on your head like a light bulb and off you go. And for a while I thought that too, because it's actually what happened with my first book. I was in Los Alamos as a tourist and I was walking around and thinking about what it was like during the Manhattan Project in the secrecy, and this light bulb went off, which was, what would have happened if there had been a crime? How would anybody go about solving it? This was a place that did not technically exist. It was off the planet. Nevertheless, it has not happened that way again, light bulb wise. And although I glibly say that all of my books begin with a place, and then I become fascinated with the place and eventually people it, and off we go, and we have some kind of story frame. In fact, it's a little more, I was thinking about this book, it's a little more messy than that. What happens is that there are stray loose ends that you never got to develop in a way that you wanted to, or a new piece of information that sort of nags at you. And ultimately, what you realize is that one book leads to the next. There aren't really clean breaks where you say, oh, today I'm going to write about South America and tomorrow I'm somewhere else. It just sort of evolves in that way. That being the case, Leaving Berlin had two parents and two books of mine in which there were things unresolved or things that I wanted to explore more, and this book was the result of. The first, was that one of those sentences that ended with a preposition? Well, you can see we're talking off cuff, right? The first and most obvious one was a book I wrote called The Good German, which is about the American occupation of Berlin in the summer of 1945. It was a book about a city which had been physically and morally devastated, that had finally reached the absolute bottom, in German Stunde Null, zero hour, after years of dictatorship and all-out war and round-the-clock bombing and a horrendous invasion by the Soviets. The city was just flat, on its feet. People were living off the crumbs of the occupying forces. Everything was for sale, including bodies, themselves. People would do anything to survive. And the greatest, the only industry that was fueling the economy was the black market, in which everyone participated, and which becomes the overriding metaphor in the book. It's because what the black market suggests is how everyone becomes corrupted by this kind of situation. And then hanging over everything, as if it weren't enough, that all this suffering and destruction was everywhere. I mean, the city was 80% of the center was destroyed. And most of the buildings, if you've been lucky enough to go back as a tourist now, in the center, those they're Disneyfied. They're completely redone, often from the original shells, but those are not the buildings that were there years ago. So we're talking about a city that's just gone. And overarching all of this, like a huge chalk mark, like a crime scene chalk mark all over the city, is the sense of this enormous crime that has taken place. A crime so vast that nobody has thought of a word to describe it yet. The word Holocaust didn't come into general usage until about 1954. So we have this. I had been fascinated by the Americans who were part of the occupying forces. I thought, well, what did they think? How did they get through this? How did we do? What was our record there? It's never talked about or taught in schools. And what you find, and what the book is very much about, is that having come and now being responsible for feeding and somehow getting this city, this country up and running again, they're also going to have to render some form of justice to this crime that nobody quite knows how to cope with. What are the levels of guilt? Who decides this? Just the conquerors? Who's guilty? The guards? The industrialists? How far up the chain? If everybody is guilty, nobody is guilty. But if nobody is guilty, somebody must be guilty. How do you figure this out? That they should have evolved a series of patchwork solutions and inadequate answers to this, and often some rough justice, shouldn't be surprising. It's 60 to 70 years later, and we're still grappling with these questions. And all you have to do is read the paper to see what is discussed in The Hague from time to time, and you can see that it never goes away. Anyway, this was a city of some horrific events and often depressing. And I lived there in my head for 2 years to write this book. And when I was finished, I thought, well, that's I'm never going back to Berlin again. I'm finished with Berlin. But maybe Berlin wasn't finished with me. It's also the case that when you live somewhere in your head, you don't just close the last page and move on. It becomes part of your personal geography. I still read anything new that comes along about Oppenheimer. I will read because I have a vested interest in Los Alamos lore. I wrote a book that was set in Istanbul, and now when I read dispatches in the paper from Turkey, I look at it in a more personal way than I would have 4 years ago. Berlin was even more special because what had begun to happen after the wall was a virtual flood of archival material and new information coming out of what had been East Berlin, East Germany, which I hadn't been aware of when I was researching the first book. Scholars needed some time to sift through. They needed to translate. I am not fluent in German. I can't read archival things in that original. But luckily enough, a lot of this was translated. And what was revealed to me was that there was this other fascinating story going on all the time down the street from the good German under the Soviet occupation. I had gone to East Berlin just basically to get a sense of the whole city, but mostly I had stayed in the West because that's where the Americans were and that's where the story was happening. Now, all of a sudden, the East was opening to me. There were places that had been inaccessible and now could be visited. So, you know, often what I call research is really just an excuse to go and spend some time in a place that I find fascinating. And I freely admit that my tourist Berlin is not necessarily your tourist Berlin or everybody's. On one of these trips, when I was trying to look at the East and go to places that I hadn't seen that I wanted to use for this book, my wife didn't come with me. She stayed in New York that week. And so it was a week of a lot of emailing and Skype. And as a typical day, she would write and say, how was your day? And I'd answer, oh, it was great. I got up really early and out to Oranienburg to get to the Sachsenhausen concentration camp. But I got back to town in time to visit the Stasi secret police headquarters and then the remand prison where people were taken, and the interrogation rooms were absolutely fascinating. And she wrote back an email saying, so glad you're having a lovely time. But that is my Berlin. I was fascinated by it. I was fascinated by how the GDR, what became East Germany, German Democratic Republic, came to be. We think of it as just another Soviet client state, a country like Poland or Hungary or something. But in fact, it was a made-up country. This was a political anomaly. It was improvised. It hadn't been planned out. It was just part of this Cold War kabuki dance that the sides were posturing with each other until finally it calcifies into two rigid ideological positions. So I thought, how does that come about? That's a really interesting story. It's a part of Berlin that I want to know more about, etc. And I knew I wanted to write about it. But how do you angle in? What particular aspect is going to give you some kind of entree to writing a book that you haven't read before, that where there's something new in it? And what began to interest me is to read the narrative account of how the Soviets, even after their appalling atrocities when they entered the city and took it in the Battle of Berlin, as an example, sometimes statistics speak louder than anything. In the first 2 months of Soviet occupation, this is before we arrived, we came in July, there were over 100,000 reported rapes. This is reported, which means that the actual number is incalculable. And you then extrapolate from that statistic and think, why were they reporting it to the very authorities who had been turning a blind eye to it in the first place? And of course, the answer was to qualify for the free abortions that were being given out at clinics to deal with this problem, this Soviet problem. Anyway, we had a truly ghastly invasion and bad feelings on both sides that were not necessarily going away. But now the Soviet line, often used through the German communist proxies, the people they had been training in Moscow all during the war, was that we are the first anti-fascists. We were the first enemies. They are going to seize the moral high ground. I was more and more fascinated by how they would just dare to do it. But dare they did. And the storyline went, it was the communists who Hitler attacked first, which was true enough. They were the first victims. The fact that we have survived at all is a wonder, but we have prevailed. And now it is we who are in the perfect position. The Americans are going to leave very soon. And after all, isn't capitalism just a more corrupt form of the sort of thing that was going on in the West before? Anyway, we are going to build the neutral, socialist, humane Germany that had always been the dream before Hitler hijacked it and ran crazy with his gangsters, etc. We are the inheritors. And to this end, one of the things that they were doing was promoting German culture. Books that had been banned or by the Nazis were reprinted. Newspaper licenses were given out. They may have been biased newspapers, but there they were in German. Theaters were opened. All kinds of things were done to give the sense that these are the great caretakers and the people who are going to lead Germany into its future. And most prominent among all of these devices, because it was showy and would get a lot of attention, was to bring back, to lure back the cultural exiles, people who had left in 1933 or fled Hitler and gone off to the West primarily, and America primarily, and now were being called back. this would, people like Bertolt Brecht, famously, who appears in the book and would be a great positive example of this. And it was at this point that the other parent of this book came to fore. I had once written a novel called Stardust, which was about the Hollywood studio system at its apogee in the mid-40s. The front story was about how this extraordinary industry, which had conquered the minds of the world and was then of a prosperity that even now is, you know, they would love to have it back. In 10 years, it was all gone. And I thought, what happened? You know, the dissolution there is interesting. But also what had interested me, particularly interested me, was the political cowardice of the studios in face of what we now call McCarthyism, but in this predated McCarthy by a few years, because the first people that the House Un-American Activities Committee went after were Hollywood. If you're going to cause some attention, you might as well do it with a movie star rather than a farmer or something. So they go after them. The backstory, however, of that book, what got me into it in the first place, was the notion of all of these émigrés, the political, cultural exiles that had come to, of all places, Los Angeles in the 40s. I was intrigued by this because I'd somehow always assumed they just went to New York and Washington or the usual suspected places. But in the 40s, Los Angeles was a city that was considered even exotic even by other Americans. It's not the L.A. that it is now. And I thought, I have never seen such a poignant and even comic kind of cultural collision. These are often people representing the last vestige of Middle European high culture. They see themselves as the last remnant, and they've escaped, and they've come out, and they're living now completely unknown to most Los Angelinos, dotting in the Hollywood Hills and in the Pacific Palisades. We're talking about people like Stravinsky and Schoenberg and Thomas Mann and Bertolt Brecht and Alma Mahler. Alma Mahler, who had been Mahler's widow and everyone else's mistress, as a matter of fact, got out. And as an example of the sort of thing I'm talking about, this preservation of culture, she was one of the people who climbed that refugee path over the Pyrenees to get out through Spain. You bribe people, border guards, and then you could walk out. And she was carrying a suitcase at the time which had Bruckner's Fourth Symphony in it, the original manuscript. She was going to save it from the Nazis. Now all of these people, the guardians of high culture, find themselves in an environment where nobody cares. They certainly don't. They don't know these people. They're interested in Bing Crosby and Bob Hope road pictures and the Grable Grosses and is the pool cleaner coming and, you know, all of those things that bespeak a Hollywood that's completely foreign and alien to these people. The result, of course, is that a lot of them have a very, very bad time. And they no longer have their language to work in. They have come to try and seek some work in the movies, but the movies aren't interested in them. But now the war is over. And who's come? They're being approached by the Soviet military authority, by the German communists in ways, and they're saying, come home, come home. We'll put your books back in print. We'll give you a lectureship at the university. You have extra rations and privileges. You can work in your language again, and you can help us build the new Germany, the one that you always thought could be possible if it weren't for this horror that had occurred. Well, how do they react to this? The people who are doing well, like Thomas Mann and Leo Funkwanger, who now I'm sure nobody has even heard of, but in those days, he used to write these door-thumping kind of biography novels, you know, Napoleon, people like that. And they were always Book of the Month Club selections, so he was really doing very well. And he and Thomas Mann, there was no reason to leave. They were happy. They were successful. Some of the others are wary. After all, there is no government over there. There's just occupying authorities. Everyone is on rations. They know that the country's in ruins. And yet, the notion that, I mean, Brecht in particular spends all these years in Los Angeles, but his language is German. He's a writer. He's not like Kurzweil, who could actually write the music. It's a very different thing. So he's tempted, wary, and then what happens to bring this all full circle, is that they feel the first early winds of the McCarthy era that's going to sweep over them. Most of these people were left-leaning to begin with, which is why they were in Hitler's crosshairs. And they're super alert to this kind of change in the political climate. After all, they have lived in Germany at a time when it was taken over. And it all seems eerily reminiscent to them of a time that they were trying to escape. And consequently, there's a kind of push, well, maybe it'll be all right. Maybe it'll be all right. Brecht, characteristically, he's going to come up in this talk a lot, is called before the House Un-American Activities Committee. And if any of you are interested in this, by the way, you should look up his testimony, and proceeds to give testimony so opaque and confusing and misdirecting that the committee thanks him for his cooperation and dismisses him because they hadn't the faintest idea what he had actually said. But you only get lucky like that once. And right after the testimony, he just went to the airport and back to Germany. For most of these people, though, this is the answer to a prayer. They're actually going, it's a homecoming. They're going to come back. So they come, and particularly the ones who had ended up in Mexico City or places even more alien than America to them. And they come back, and what they find, of course, is a wasteland. When Brecht returns in October 48, his first morning, a scene that I, let's just say it has resonance in our book, but I cribbed it, you know, and gave it to my own character. But the first thing he does is he gets up out of the hotel at dawn and walks down to Hitler's chancellery and sits there on this mound of rubble and has a cigar and just looks at it. The marble has already been taken away to make the Soviet war memorial. He's sitting on a heap of bricks. And of course, there's this sense of, I'm here. I survived and you're gone. But you look around and everything else is gone too. And the Berlin, the Weimar Berlin of the Three Penny Opera is never coming back. Nevertheless, it is possible in those early idealistic days when they arrived to believe that maybe something could happen here, could be worked out, that they are part of a grand social experiment. And promises that were made tend to be kept. Anna Segers, who was a very, very prominent writer then, not so well known now, had languished for years in Mexico City, and now all of a sudden they have her cutting ribbons, opening factories. She's a celebrity. Walter Janka, who had also been in, was given the studio to run, the big film studio, and later the major publishing house. These were huge jobs at the time, and they were just given over. And Bertolt Brecht did, in fact, get his theater and the repertory company that exists to this day, although not in the theater that where you see it now. It's a different theater, two blocks away or something. However, and it was then on January 11th, 1949, that Brecht opens in this original theater that he's promised, Mother Courage and Her Children, and it becomes this watershed moment in European culture. It's a real landmark production. Decades later, people would say things like, oh, I was there when Elena Weigel played Mother Courage. And it was a scene that seemed to me so extraordinary and dramatic that I think it may have been what prompted me to do the book in the first place, because even as they're sitting there and the airlift planes are going over, trying to supply this besieged, sectored city. And people are fighting over tickets so they can get the opening night tickets. And the Americans are there, and the British and the French, because this is truly a moment. And it seems for that one evening that somehow Germany is alive again, and the cultural diaspora is over, and it is alive in the East. It seems as if the whole Soviet policy of bringing these people back is somehow justified. And it was at that moment that this mini light bulb, a modest light bulb, went off. And I thought, you know, anyone in that privileged position, I mean, these people were being revered and they were above suspicion. They were acclaimed, the last people you would look to be making trouble. And I thought, what if one of them were actually there as a spy, and using this privileged position in ways that nobody, least of all the Soviets, would dream could be happening, particularly if it was someone who was there because he had run afoul of the HUAC committee the way Brecht almost did. Hence our protagonist, Alex Meyer, who is a Berlin-born writer who fled in 1933. He's half-Jewish, and he was politically active as a socialist, and he fled, rightly, to save his life, and has made a new life in California. But asked to testify in front of the committee, he decides to take a principled stand and not name any names, which is now going to get him deported, so that he is not a U.S. citizen. So he's going to lose contact with his son, whom he adores, his family. And he is open to cutting a side deal with the fledgling CIA, who come to him and say, go back as one of these honored exiles, but we want you to be working for us. And if this all works out, we'll get you back. We'll talk to the State Department. We'll engineer this. This is a Faustian bargain that should never have been made, but he makes it and, of course, discovers almost instantly that he's in over his head before he even knows how to start, and that what the CIA has in mind, without telling him up front, is that the primary assignment is going to be to spy on the only woman he's ever loved who is still alive in Berlin. Leaving Berlin is about the life that these returning exiles found, and the moral ambiguity of their position and the increasingly ambivalent acts of collaboration that they are forced to participate in. Because when all is said and done, for all this cultural patina, the Russians are ruthless occupiers. They're greedy for reparations. They would take whole factories and just ship them back east. They're totally indifferent to the fate of POWs. The German soldiers were being used as slave labor for 10 years after the war. And for that matter, they're indifferent to the German population, who were drafted into labor gangs, often in very dangerous situations, which appear in the book. And they are also, at the same time, with the help of the German communists, putting together the infrastructure for what is going to become the police state par excellence. It's in 1948 and 49, at the time of this book, that what will become the Stasi is formed, that all of these things are being put in place so that we have, by the time of its heyday later in the 1970s, something like 180,000 paid informants in a country of 20 million people. There's never, ever been anything quite like this. So what these people, for all of their good intentions, have found when they come back is that they've come back to prison. How they deal with this varies, because it would. Some people cannot give up the one idea that they've ever had. The idea is all that they're living for now, and they will either go into a form of denial or simply ignore it and say, we will build East Germany. We will build this workers' paradise. Others are a little more cynical and think that they can manipulate the system and perhaps still keep their privileges and yet not really bow to the kind of pressure that's being put on them. Brecht famously is one of these. The Soviet authorities become his new HUAC. He's constantly befuddling them. And they're leery. They don't really want to mess with him, because who needs a public squabble with Brecht? So he keeps his theater and he keeps his privileges. But then there's poor Walter Janke, the man I mentioned before, who got the studio and the publishing company. What he then gets is the next round of Stalinist purges. Now it's time to go back to the late 30s. Let's round up people. Let's have show trials. Let's put them away. And very anti-Semitic too, by the way. And so Walter is accused and sent away to 5 years solitary for counter-revolutionary activities, that activity being that when he escaped Hitler, he went to the West. And just being in the West is cause of infection. So we now have this final twist in the surreal ideology that's been going on in the city for so long. When the thaw comes, after Stalin dies, he's released, and he stays in East Berlin. And this at a time, years before the wall went up, when all you had to do to leave East Berlin was to cross the street. You just crossed a line. Leaving Berlin is about several lines that get crossed from east to west, from one ideology to the next. Alex crosses a line when he accepts this deal with the CIA. He crosses a line when he lies to somebody he loves and befriends. He crosses a line when he pulls a trigger. I won't tell you in what context. But there are lines he won't cross. And what the book is about is, where do we draw our own lines? Where are the sector boundaries of our own personal morality? What would we do or not do to leave Berlin when so much would depend on it? Maybe our life, maybe someone else's. How do you figure that out? I hope that, these questions intrigue me enough to write the book. I hope that they will intrigue you when you read it. I hope you will also find it entertaining. And now that I've answered the most frequently asked question, are there less frequently asked questions that you would like to have answered and we could go into our Q&A? Yes.
How did you become interested in this part of history?
Okay, the question was, how did I become interested in this part of history, the period of history? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, the quick answer is that it first happened by happenstance, because my first novel was Los Alamos during the making of the atom bomb. And, you know, once you've researched a period, you want it, there's more and more and more. It just gets richer. The more you know, the more you want to know. And it leads to the next. And besides, why throw out all that perfectly good research, you know, and start from scratch? So I did that. But that's a glib answer. The real answer, I think, as I realized that all of my books were focusing on this period, I think the immediate post-war period is inherently rich and dramatic, but it's the beginning of our world, and it's when our universe begins historically. I think that World War II is a great, great demarcation line. There's a fracture line. Things are very different afterwards. And, you know, we're also self-involved that we think that everything that happens to us is a seminal moment or, you know, a major turning point in history. And it is a seminal moment in the sense that it happens to us. But there are some periods where truly things change in society or the world shifts on its axis. I think that when the first test bomb went off at Alamogordo, there was before and there was after. It shifted. This wasn't a bigger bow and arrow. This wasn't just a perfected grenade. This was the possibility of self-annihilation. That's a moment where you draw in a breath and say, let's stop and think about it. What does this mean? I think that in the West, in Western societies, the revelation of the Holocaust operates that way in a moral universe. This is, after all, we in the West had been justifying for hundreds of years taking over the rest of the world on the grounds that we were more civilized and evolved. And here we are. So you begin to deal with that. It's a time when I think perfectly ordinary people, just like you and me, are put in situations where they're making decisions that are going to have ramifications for 50 years. So I'm drawn to the period. I think it's a really important time. And luckily hadn't been as well explored as some others. So, you know, writers are always opportunistic in that way. I think, you know, this business about the effect of the war, I have used, and I've said this before, so you may even have heard it before, because I've been a tattered cover before. But the metaphor that I always use, the easy metaphor to describe the impact of the war, is a movie metaphor. I think World War II begins with Casablanca. It's literally shot in February 42, right after Pearl Harbor. And everything is crystal clear and black and white and romantic. You know when to stand up for the Marseillaise and you know who's who. But the war ends with the third man. And I think there you have a world of true, murky, moral ambiguity. Things are not what they seem. The charismatic protagonist of this film is somebody who is selling adulterated penicillin that cripples children. And he's the protagonist. You know, so I think that the world we inherited is not the world of Casablanca. I think it's the world of the third man. And I think it begins in that post-war period. I'm sorry, a long-winded answer to what was a perfectly fine question. Yes.
Walking across the street. What year was it that the wall went up and people couldn't do that anymore?
Okay, question was, can you really just go from one sector to the other crossing the street? Were people being watched in doing it? And when did the wall go up? Let's work backwards. The wall didn't go up till 1961. So between 45 and 61, all that you had to do, I mean, one of the reasons, the reason for the wall, or the East German justification, was that they were losing too many people, because someone would just pack a little bag and get on the subway, you know, the L, and at Friedrichstrasse, you'd just, you know, change trains, and the next thing you know, you're in the West. But there is a kind of more complicated timeline. I mean, one of the, what we always imagine then is, well, why didn't everybody leave? You know, well, the fact is, they'd only be leaving for the similar version of what they already had. I mean, you have to imagine what the situation was in the late 40s there. It's all ruins. The whole city. It's not just one sector rather than the next. If you're lucky enough to have a place to live at all, you're very reluctant to give it up. If you have a work permit, and even more importantly, a ration card, and the ration card is given out by whatever occupational authority is running your sector, so to speak, this is not something you can walk away from lightly. You have to go and apply for another one, and who knows? So there isn't this kind of mass exodus. And since the whole city is under military occupation, it is not even perceived that one is somehow more enlightened than the next. You know, people are working in both sides. But where it all begins to go haywire and screwy is exactly this time at 48, 49, because what happens is the currency reform. Up until that point, they were using occupation marks, which favored the Soviets because they would just printed them. And once it was decided that they needed some hard-based currency, things began to split immediately because you were paid in one currency or next. In 1949, in the spring, what became West Germany was finally formulated as a political entity, and the response in the East, in October 49, was to create what became East Germany. But it's still years before that has a meaningful day-to-day impact. You know, our notion now is that East Berlin was, oh, the electricity is usually not working, it's grim, it's gray, the whole thing is potholes, it's really very bad. And then you get to the Kurfürstendamm, and here are all the Chevrolets and the swishy cars and the bright lights. The showcase of democracy. Well, that was true, but that wasn't true until almost the late 50s. So for years and years, there was not really a lot of incentive to be moving around in that way. Once it became clear that you were escaping an oppressive system, then all the things that we're familiar with begin to kick in. But yeah, you could really just walk across this. You walk through the Brandenburg Gate, and you'd be in one sector or another. Yes. The question is, was I in the CIA, or have I studied their methods, or why do I have this intrigue? I have to tell you, by the way, I was once doing a book event in Washington, D.C., where half the audience presumably is in the CIA, and someone said to me, how did you come with such excellent trade craft? And I said, I made it up. You know, you just make it up. I was never been in the CIA and never recruited. And in fact, the one, I'm sure there are many criticisms that can be made of the book, but one that could genuinely be made is that the CIA as presented in this book is a great deal more sophisticated and knowledgeable than in fact it was. I mean, it was just formed in 47. So we're talking about a very, very new group over there and a few OSS, people.
You've got so many groups.
Right. You know, the Russians are masters at it. The Russians, ever since the days of the czars, truly believe in the power of secret police and espionage. It's something that's almost in the DNA. We're new to it at this point, in 1948-49. And then there are the Germans themselves, and the British. I mean, everyone's there playing off each other. This question of, where does this stuff come from, I think that our popular culture is saturated with espionage details, some of which may have come out of a true situation. But the interesting thing to me is how the fiction reinforces itself. I keep thinking of that wonderful moment when they were shooting The Godfather and real mafia people would come and advise them on clothes and costume because they'd say, no, he'd never wear a hat like that. He'd wear this hat. So that, in fact, the movie's accurate thanks to the mafia. You know, right.
So when you were
okay, so how does writing happen? Now, this is where you get into the magical thinking part. And I can say, who knows? You know, I mean, look, I don't write from outline. And I do, in a sense, make it up as I go along. But you have to have some general sense of where the story is going. I mean, I think there's no pleasure in it for me if all I'm doing is coloring or filling in the dots. You know, you want the story to breathe in a way that it can take you places. I am not subscribing to that notion that, oh, the characters tell me what to do. This is nonsense. I'm writing the characters. You know, I mean, for better or for worse, it's my decision to do this. But you need to rein it in. You don't want to go off on a tangent. And there is, you know, I find plot the least interesting thing to do, but there is, in fact, a kind of watchmaker fascination quality to it that I'm beginning to respond to more and more as I write it. But ultimately, all that matters is people, is the character. You know, when you think about even books that you hold dear and love, if called upon to actually give us the story, you might stumble a bit. It's the people that you remember. Yes? Oh, okay. The people. I mean, I think this is true of all literature. I mean, isn't this what it's about? It's trying to put you, us, me, in somebody else's shoes. You know, how does the world look from that point of view? I once was asked to address a writer's class, a creative writing class, and I said, here's your assignment. Somebody is in a room. Somebody else comes into the room. They talk. Neither of these people is you. And now just do anything you want. Be someone else. You know, that's what it's about. I think that there's a kind of misnomer, so to speak, when they say, oh, you should really, you know, only write what you know. And I thought, why don't you write what you'd like to know, what interests you? I mean, I know about me. I don't want to write autobiography where I know as much as I want to know. But there's this whole vast, various world out there filled with all kinds of wondrous, interesting things. And I want to know more about that, you know, not about how did I really feel about my mother when I was 8, you know. It's too late for that, you know. All right, you, Russ? Yeah.
I just wonder if you had to, once you get the book written towards the end of the process, if you have somebody who knows something about, you know, the historical context or the trade craft, if you will, if you have somebody like that vet it for you so you don't inadvertently say something that's really spun out?
Yeah, okay. The question was, do I have somebody who vets the manuscript so I don't say something really egregious and silly? Well, first of all, most of the espionage tradecraft is, I think, minor key in these books. The short answer is that I don't, and I probably should. I mean, occasionally, if there's a real technical issue, I will consult somebody. And, for instance, I did it in Los Alamos because even though I thought I knew how the bomb worked, I realized that, you know, if you were doing it as an exam, you just need to have a more sophisticated scientific mind there. But in general, I don't. And this can sometimes get you in real trouble, you know, because particularly if you write in period, inevitably there are going to be mistakes. Now, we're talking about small mistakes, you know, like there's a bridge and there wasn't a bridge until 1952, you know, something like that. And mostly people don't notice, but you want to get it right. I mean, as long as you're doing this kind of work, A, you want to do it just for the self-satisfaction of it being right. You also don't want to stop the reader on the page, which it would do if they noticed that something was off. And the third is that now that everybody is available through the internet on email, you just get so much crank mail on email of complaining about any mistakes, you know, so you have to be very careful. One of the mistakes I once made was that I described a gun that was used in Berlin, in fact, in The Good German. And I had been to the Museum of the Allies, and I'd faithfully copied down what the number was and, you know, the gun and all this stuff, because I don't know anything about guns. And I got it wrong. What I hadn't remembered was whether it was a slingback or a cylinder, one of those kinds. So I got it wrong. And a wonderfully astute copy editor picked it up and said, no, you know, and changed it, luckily. Except that they didn't make the change on the set of galleys that was going to the UK for the UK edition. So for months afterwards, I was getting emails from Australia that would say things like, any bloody fool knows that this gun doesn't work this way. You know, what's wrong with you? And finally, I thought, why don't I just push people out of windows? You know, I mean, I don't care about the guns and how they die. It's just, why did they do it? You know. Yes. Right. The question was, how long did it take for most of the returning exiles to realize that they were in a trapped or compromised situation and not at all what they had imagined? You know, it's a very funny thing. For some of them, it took a long time because they really were true believers. And the kind of initial suffering became part of the appeal. It's like we're all on rations and we're all trying to rebuild this rubble city and my sweater doesn't keep me warm enough, but that's all of us are in the same boat. You know, that there was that kind of ethos. Brecht, of course, had a car and driver, but he was Brecht. He always had a different kind of game going on. A lot of them got it right away that they were being used. Some of them were willing pawns. They were treated very well. And all of a sudden, having wasted 12 years of their lives or been ignored for 12 years, they were becoming significant figures in this society, such as it was. And it was very hard to let go of that. So they hung on. And they believed a lot of the propaganda. I mean, it wasn't as if the Americans were a bright and shining example of a terrific alternative for them. You know, I mean, what the Russians were always saying was, look at who's employing the ex-Nazis, you know, all of Adenauer's government. Blah, 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 which isn't strictly speaking true, and it conveniently overlooks the fact that the Russians were using them too. Nevertheless, we did, you know. Yes?
The intersection of literature and Hollywood, what do you feel about the adaptation of The Big Journey?
The question was, how much did I love the adaptation of The Good German? All right. Well, I always vowed that I would never diss the movie in public because, you know, you're delighted that, because I took the check, you know. That is, in fact, once it cleared, I was on their side. But, you know, look, it's a standard trope that writers always complain about movie versions of their work. I had hoped to avoid that because I saw so many people go through the process when I was a publisher, and I thought, look, it always ends in tears because you're under the mistaken notion that this is an illustrated version of your novel. And that's not the case. You know, the novel that I wrote, the movie in my head, is never going to be the one they're going to make, and you have to be a grown-up about that and just let them take ownership and hope for the best, you know, that they'll find something that will inspire them. Having said that, it would have been nice if they had used even a single line from the book or, you know, anything that really made sense. I mean, I should have known that there was trouble ahead when I was very friendly with one of the line producers who would write me from time to time because he wanted to know historical things, like, you know, were there sector barriers and something like that. And I was only too eager to help, etc. And he called at one point and said, wonderful news. And at this point, the movie was already set with George Clooney and Cate Blanchett, and I thought I had ascended into heaven. It was just a dream cast. It was everything I could have hoped for. And Ben, the producer, said, we've just signed Tobey Maguire. And I said, really? For what part? And he said, for Tully. And there's this silence, and he said, I said, but Tully's a corpse, right, in the book. He said, we're building up the part, right? And I thought, this is not going to end well. And, you know, and with all the goodwill in the world, it didn't end well. But I have great hopes that it may become a cult classic, and we may actually sell a few books as a result, but I don't know. But, you know, you can't do this crying over spilt milk thing, and this notion of, oh, what have they done to my child? There was another writer who said to me, and on the grounds of commiseration, you know, it's going to be, oh, you must know how it feels. You know, oh, I was in such pain. And I looked at him and I said, you know, can I tell you something that might make you feel better? The book I wrote, for better or for worse, is on the shelf exactly the way I wrote it. And it will always be on the shelf the way I wrote it. I didn't make the movie. I'm not taking that weight. You know, anyway. But wouldn't it be nice if it had worked? You know. Yes.
How did your previous editorial publishing experience influence your writing?
Okay, how did publishing influence me as a writer? There are two parts of this. One, the actual writing itself. Everybody faces a blank piece of paper. It's not a transferable skill set, so the one has nothing to do with it. You know, if anything, you, because you've read so much terrible stuff over the course of a, you know, publishing career, you're more alert to bad tone. You know, you become more self-critical, but you get over that. You know, so as a writer, I think it has very little influence. What's much more interesting is what happens when you publish the book and go through this process. I mean, I know, because I was in the business, how many things go wrong and how they can go wrong without it being anybody's fault, that sometimes it just plays out that way. But writers and publishers have different focus. You know, a publisher may be doing 150 books that season. You're doing one. So there's a very different kind of sense of attention that's being paid. What I had hoped when I started this was, knowing how that works, is that I didn't want to be a pain in the butt writer. I didn't want to be one of those people who would be a problem. And consequently, what you want to do is find really good publishing people and let them be them, let them do it. You know, it's their job. The last thing they want is you looking over their shoulder saying, oh, are you sure about the jacket? You know, there's a, I mean, I've been very, very lucky because the people I've worked with are people I respect. They're good. But you have to let them do it. Anything else? Well, yep.
What's next?
Okay, well, I told this nice gentleman over there that I never say what the book is because I'm afraid of talking it out, and I'm afraid of the reaction you often get, which is somebody saying, oh, really? Oh, that's interesting. You know, and they slink away, and you think, oh, my God, and I'm halfway through it. So I never do. But insofar as all my books are about place, I can tell you that I'm planning a trip to Moscow. Okay. Ooh, so is that intriguing, or should I change my mind? Okay. Okay, enough. Thank you so much. It was lovely.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.